Thanks, Dan. We're going to continue on this morning in Matthew 5. I'm going to read verses 21 through 28, which is the subject matter for the message this morning. You have heard that the ancients were told, "You shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever says to his brother, 'You good for nothing,' shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. Therefore, if you are presenting your offering at the altar and there remember your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, so that your opponent may not hand you over to the judge to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Truly I say to you, you will not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. You have heard that it is said, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So the sermon up to this point, the first verses I read this morning, have presented the heart or internal righteousness. Blessed are they that are poor in spirit. They know they're poor in spirit. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. There's a picture there. So what is this person like? How are you going to recognize him if you meet him? Perhaps knowing him or her, or perhaps a chance meeting. The question is bound to come up. What are his or her life and actions going to look like? What will they do? What will they refrain from doing? Now, I said before that the Sermon on the Mount is opposed to human nature, or perhaps becomes impossible without resort to divine character. And so, if you see two small toddlers playing together or squabbling together, it's a wonderful picture of basic human nature. What are some of the first words they learn? Mine. No. Okay. And they have to be carefully taught concepts like sharing, which is totally foreign to human nature, because you're going to find with two toddlers, if the one picks up a toy, even if the other one isn't playing with it or interested in it, but it's theirs, immediately what do you hear? "That's mine. You can't play with that." So in verse 20, we read the admonition that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, the scribes and Pharisees were very zealous for the law. They complained when Jesus healed on the Sabbath. And that's an example of placing their interpretation of the law as being of higher importance than compassion for someone who was sick. So you had the man with a withered hand, you had the woman that was bent way over, and Jesus said to the scribes and Pharisees, "Well, you let your donkey out and untie the donkey to get it water on the Sabbath day because it's thirsty. What about this person? Should I not loose them? They've been bound by disease for years." They said, "No. Now, practical application is a little complicated, and there is some hyperbole to get our attention. Makes us think of the statement, to follow Jesus, we have to hate our mother and father by comparison. Now, that verse has been misused and misinterpreted by many. It does not mean we're supposed to hate our parents, but it does mean that the devotion to Christ is of a higher degree. And so the points in here are about heart condition, manner of life. Elsewhere it says Christians are what? A peculiar people. Strange, different. Considered by some to be goofy. Zealous for good works. So in this portion, look for a couple of phrases. Number one, you have heard it said. Okay. Now that speaks to those who have been teaching. Remember, this is a largely illiterate age. Okay. The reason scribes were called scribes is what? They could read and write. So they went to the synagogue on Saturday, and they heard these things read, and they heard these things taught. Early church was much the same way. It says, faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Why? Because it was hearing rather than reading. So those who were teaching were most likely the scribes, Pharisees, the priestly class. And all of the people being taught had heard these various things at one time or another. So when he says, you have heard it said, he's bringing it to their remembrance. And so what has been heard by the people listening to this sermon is the standard of righteousness that he's saying, you've got to do better. This has got to be surpassed. So the first question in mind is, how? How will we surpass it? So the people listening, take yourself back to there, say, wait a minute, I've heard all these things. What am I supposed to do now? And so we look for the other phrase. Number one is, you have heard it said. Number two is, but I say. The word but speaks to contrast. Not this, but that. So as Jesus spoke to the law and the prophets earlier in the sermon, like back in verse 17, he said he did not come to abolish but fulfill. He claims for himself the authority to interpret the law and the prophets. And by that interpretation, when he says, but I say, he's bringing his audience to a fuller understanding, a more complete understanding. Fulfill can also mean bring to completion. So here's what I want you to know, and this is what I want you to do. Verse 21 speaks to murder, and the sixth commandment speaks to this. And the teaching is that they heard, whoever does this shall be liable to the court. And so the crime is linked to the punishment. Out on 86, you could see this every day. So you drive along and some guy passes you like you're standing still, and up in the cutoff is a state trooper. Guy slows right down. Why is he slowing right down? Fear of punishment. Same thing here. So the fear of punishment from the human court deters the crime. If I do this, then the court will do that to me. But there's no mention of the commands of God. There's no mention of the condition of the heart. This speaks to you'll be liable to the court. This is where our society has arrived today, by the way. In our big cities, the rate of murder has been increasing fairly quickly over the last few years. Police presence has been cut back, and many places are experimenting with defunding the police. And they're finding that the fear of the human court has diminished. What happened when they took shoplifting from a crime down to a misdemeanor and the police didn't even want to arrest for it? So much stuff got stolen, stores shut down and moved away. They couldn't make out. There was no human court that was deterring that behavior. And so this becomes a vicious cycle. The less there is fear of the human court, fear of justice, the street becomes more lawless. In turn, people who witness a crime might say, well, they're not going to do anything about it anyway, or they're going to let him out tomorrow and he'll come back and do something to me. And so lawlessness continues to spiral. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, if a murder is secret, or if no one dares testify about what they have seen due to the lawless nature of the street, if it's not found out or cannot be found out, then there's no liability before the court. Is it still a problem then? Is fear of the court the only deterrent to this kind of behavior? I've said before that before the age of 11, the good Sunday school teacher can do more for an errant boy than after the age of 18, all the police, courts, and parole officers all put together can do, because that faithful Sunday school teacher can put his steps on the right path. Every society has had to find a way to socialize young men. And there's methods to do it, whether it be Africa or China or Indonesia, anywhere across the world. They vary, but the aim is always the same. And if we're not socializing our young people, and particularly young men, then society in those areas is going to break down. Murder is the overt act. It's easily seen. There's proof of it. It's easily understood. But then we have to ask, where does it come from? What are the conditions of the heart that'll permit somebody to do something like this? And I'm sure everyone here is thinking, I would never want to do that. Don't care to. Well, Jesus explains that the person who is angry with his brother or calls his brother names has anger in his heart, which is a precondition to murder. So now I ask, are we sometimes angry? The answer is yes. Do we hold grudges, sometimes for years? I think that's something a lot of people work on and struggle with. Someone did this, someone did that, and it really hurt. The very first murder by Cain was caused by jealousy and anger. And if there was to be no law and no consequence, would we then be tempted to actually murder the object of our anger? Is the law and the effectiveness of the law the only thing holding anarchy at bay. So are the people out there murderers held in check by the law? This is where our society has ended up in certain areas, certain neighborhoods. What about us? I don't answer the question for us. I leave it to the individual. Anger will generally bring some kind of manifestation, such as calling names or the disregard of our fellow or neighbor, as though we have judged him to be unworthy of our fellowship or our notice. We might consider this person as raka, which is in some translations, or simply a worthless fellow. He's not worth our time. He's not worth our notice. So rather than fellowship with this person, perhaps he or she is quietly excluded. Somebody who doesn't measure up. Much of what is called bullying today, and I had bullies in school because I was always the smallest kid in class. They weren't subtle about their bullies. They pushed you down or gave you a couple cracks. Much of what's called bullying today is not punching, but it's rather the practice of freezing somebody out of a group. So there's various means or methods of telling them by the standards of that group, they have no worth and they're not worthy of being in the group. So you can talk to somebody who's 50 years old and there was a birthday party when they were 8 and every child in the class was invited, but they were not invited. 40-odd years later, they still remember, because it was a message to them that they were not worth enough to be invited. They're frozen out of fellowship, but we all need that. We all like to be part of a group. And they might be called a fool. That was a harsh insult at the time this was written. So why do people do these things? You ever remember being mean to other children when you were in grade school? I remember. You know, we had some girl that was big and heavy. Everyone teased her for being heavy. We had a place they called the apartment house. There's one big apartment house in town, small town. And anyone that lived there was kind of out in the outer limits, because that's where the poor people lived. I remember these things, not with pride. And notice what Jesus is speaking about. He's not speaking about overt acts, something could clearly be seen, but rather to the condition of the heart. Because when people do things like this, it speaks to the condition of their heart. And so it reminds us of his teaching about unwashed hands. They were eating with unwashed hands, and the religious leaders were all bent out of shape. He said, what? Whatever you eat goes into the stomach, eventually find its way to the latrine. That can't defile you. Now, we're not speaking of germs here, by the way. So, he says, what comes from the heart and manifests itself out of your mouth and out of your action? That is what defiles a person. The state of the heart. Not whether or not you wash your hands. Verses 23 and 24 speak to an offering in the temple. And Jesus advises, before making such an offering, if your brother has something against you, go first and make it right. And so here again, we speak to a heart issue. Okay, did you have a big argument with someone? Do you owe them money that you never paid them? Did you agree to do something and then not do it? The offering in the temple is a ceremonial offering. Okay? So if I put money in the collection, I could put money in the collection regardless of the state of my heart. I can have wicked thoughts. I can have bad intent. I can have all sorts of things around me. I could still put the money in. And he said, before you give an offering, go make these things right. So making things right is a different issue. It's a heart issue. It can be difficult to make things right. An offering in the temple, just like the offering here at the, in the shoebox at the back of the room here, is an act of worship. We worship by giving, we worship by singing, we worship by praying, we worship by preaching, all different facets of the same diamond that we call worship. So, can we expect God to accept this act of worship if we are estranged from our fellow man? And so, to go to worship, if the heart is not right, it's futile. He said, get things going. Keep short accounts. Now, what are the elements to making things right? First, we have to admit there's a problem. Now, that sounds simple enough, but in actuality, people tend to justify their own behavior. Well, I did this because of that. Well, okay, but was it right what you did? So just as it's easy to see flaws in other people, it's correspondingly hard to see flaws in ourselves. You know? I mean, I would gladly admit a mistake if I ever made one. I put a sign on my desk one time, those of you who think you know everything are very annoying to those of us who do. I did do that. And so it's a problem. There is a problem. It's got to morph. It's got to change into what? I have a problem. It's not too hard to say there is a problem out here, but it's hard to say I have a problem. Because to admit I have a problem is going to be cause for me to struggle and overcome my pride because I like to think well of myself. Let me tell you something. The laziest man in the shop will tell you how hard a worker he is. He believes it even if no one else does, because we like to think well of ourselves. So, now, in any problem, in any dispute, it's unlikely that all the wrong is on one side. As a general rule, the difficulty is a shared problem. We might want to read a book called Dancing with Porcupines. It deals with getting along with difficult people. But the instruction is first to own and then correct the problem on your side. If you can't work on the other person, and you probably can't, then you need to work on yourself. That you can do. And that does not mean the other person will meet you halfway. They might not. Perhaps they will not. But then there's another command from God which says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And so we are commanded also to overcome evil with good. Another counterintuitive command, although it does work. Finally, it's to be done promptly. So the picture is, leave your offering there, go get the problem resolved, then you can come back. mend offenses, keep short accounts. And so, leaving this concept of the gift at the altar, we're given another example from the ancient world. It says, make friends quickly with your opponent at law while on the way and before you face the judge. Once you're in front of the judge, it's too late to make things right. It's too late to compromise because punishment is at hand. All of us travel through life, and as we travel, all of us are really on the way to stand before the judge of all the earth. Now, many courts today offer what's called a plea bargain. So rather than going through the time or expense of a trial, they'll say, okay, plead down to X, and you're going to get X punishment, and it'll be done. And you'll get some people who will say, no, I'm going to roll the dice and go to trial. And some of these very same people find, after they have gone to trial, that when convicted, the punishment is much more onerous than what they had been offered. Then they would have liked to get what was agreed to on the way. Strife and difficulty are bound to come up. But here we're advised to settle things quickly while there's a chance. I believe that in this life we'll often find windows that'll open. And while the windows open, there's a chance to do something, okay? Could be to resolve an issue with a friend. Could be to do something in a relationship or a marriage or an employer-employee relationship. There's a chance to restore something or fix something. But if action is not taken in a given time, I also believe that window can close. And once closed, it's not possible to fix it, whatever it was. So friendship, relationship, employment, marriage, whatever. So if the window is open, this passage is urging us to take the opportunity. Do what you can before it fades away. If we make no attempt to make things right, there can be a long and a painful payment through our lack of action. Now, in verse 27, Jesus starts dealing with adultery, and we can see the pattern repeating himself. He moves beyond the observable act to speak to the heart. In the law, it states you shall not commit adultery. This was well known to the hearers. They heard it in the synagogue. Now we hear again the phrase, but I say to you, followed by the statement that everyone who looks on a woman with lust in their heart has committed adultery already. As we read through the Ten Commandments, the commandment to not commit adultery is followed by the commandment to what? Not covet your neighbor's wife. Now, the word covet has always given me problems because, you know, when do you cross the line between wanting something, okay, I really want that shiny new car, and coveting that thing? Webster's dictionary is a little help. It's an inordinate desire for something that would cause you to overlook norms, laws, rules in your pursuit of that something, whatever it might be. That's coveting. So this act of coveting could be an ox, a donkey, or anything of the neighbor is this inordinate desire to have something that doesn't belong to us. So before a person steals anything, they first covet it. Oh, I want this. I don't have the money to buy it. I'm just going to take it. And the desire is particularly damaging when it blinds our eyes to the violation of the law and the consequences. It makes us break vows to satisfy this covetous desire. So Jesus goes on to say, if you covet the neighbor's wife, you have desired to commit adultery with her. You've already done that deed in your heart. Once the deed is desired in the heart, it doesn't take much to go ahead and take action on that desire. So, I mean, if somebody is coveting something in the store, it just takes a little push to shoplift that item to satisfy that covetous desire. Just like the hatred and anger in the heart leading to murder, the desire for intimate relations colors many areas of our society today. Quite simply, there are people who are looking for this sort of thing, and they're looking all the time. So my wife might say to me, when I don't notice something, she might say, you can drive down the road at 65 miles an hour and see a deer at the wood line in this field over here. But why can't you see this that's important to me? Well, it's what I'm looking for, if you see what I mean. And so there are some people looking for this sort of thing all the time. And they're open to a change or something different or variety. From that tendency comes the divorce rate, the decline in marriages, the loss of a stable family, the children who suffer, and the loss of the relationship many times of the biological parents to the biological children. And the whole society is suffering today from that, from unbridled coveting, basically. But Jesus is saying, your actions aren't there, but your heart is there first. And if your heart is there first, you better work on that before your actions go there later. Now, in Matthew, the verses we are reading, in 17 and 18, he said, don't think I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. And he says, no jot or tittle will pass away from the law. And so if we go back to these verses, we can very clearly see that what Jesus said is, what I am teaching is not contrary to the law. It doesn't abolish the law. Okay? What I'm doing is I'm fulfilling the law. We think of what Paul said at the end of 1 Corinthians 12. He's talking about gifts in the church. He's talking how to do things. But at the end of verse 12, and he said, and behold, I show you a more excellent way. Then we get chapter 13 on essentially, they call it the love chapter, but essentially it's what is coming from the heart. Okay, you're doing these things. Why are you doing them? So Jesus did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. Now, fulfill doesn't always mean a prophecy coming to pass. Many prophecies were fulfilled in the life and ministry of Christ, but it can also mean complete or bring to completion, if you get out your faithful Greek dictionary. So with the statement, But I say, okay, this is what you've been taught, this is what I say. He's showing the godly interpretation of these teachings. He's helping us get it right. So if I had to sum it up, I would say that all of this behavior, and society's been trying this for years and years and years, cannot be enforced from the outside of the person. Because guess what? The guy just slowed down when he saw the state trooper sitting in the cutoff. After he gets by the trooper, it's going to speed right up again. Okay? That is an external force working on behavior. When the external force is removed and the guy gets past the trooper, the behavior goes right back to what it was. The behavior then has got to flow from the heart. And this means the heart has to be right first. The inside condition to the outside behavior, rather than exterior forces regulating exterior behavior. Oh, we got this rule, we got this rule, we got this rule, we got this rule. But the bottom line is, just like children, if adults don't esteem the rules, as soon as the enforcement is out of sight, they're going to do what they wanted to do anyway. So if the church is going to do anything, the church has to speak to the condition of the heart. Then, when the heart is right and the Holy Spirit is active, behavior will then flow from the inside to the outside. And we assume at that point we'll get it right. We'll have our closing hymn now.